Hello, you are listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 15, Checkmate. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades. One of my favorite hobbies, for which I sadly do not have time these days, is chess. And in chess, there are basically two styles of play. One is tactical, the other is positional. The tactical player is always sharp, ready to make bold moves, on the lookout for any blunder by their opponent that can be exploited ruthlessly in order to unleash a devastating attack. This style of play is often flashy and very fun to watch, as games can end abruptly in move combinations that are aesthetically pleasing for those watching. However, in playing this way, the tactical player occasionally commits his or her own blunders, and a bold move can backfire, and the player can meet their own unexpected defeat. The positional player, by contrast, is calm, patient, willing to exploit an opponent's blunder, but instead of trying to bait them, the positional player prefers to secure a small positional advantage as soon as possible, and then slowly build on this advantage. This positional superiority grows and grows until, like the hapless prey of a boa constrictor, the opponent has had the life squeezed out of their position and is forced to admit defeat, bewildered as to where exactly they went wrong. To a casual observer, tactical play can often be considered cool chess, while positional play is often considered boring. But nowadays, positional play is the dominant form of play at the highest levels of chess, for the simple reason that it wins the most games. Do not be mistaken, this is not to say that any positional player will be superior to any tactical player. Any grandmaster worth a pawn knows how to play both styles. It's just that, all things being equal, positional play is considered the safer style with the highest success rate. Now, if you could not possibly care less about chess, then you will have to forgive me for opening this episode with this analogy. If the Russian Revolution has been like a chess match between the Bolsheviks, representing the proletariat and the peasant masses on the one side, and the aristocracy, bourgeoisie, and petty bourgeoisie as embodied in the provisional government and the parties of the cadets, SRs, and Mensheviks on the other, then we are about to see that the revolution will be won by the masses, not thanks to flashy tactics, but to brilliant positional play. But okay, let's back up a minute. We spent the last episode putting the final pieces on the chessboard. Now it's time to move them into position. When we last left off, the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petro-Soviet had been declared, and the question on everyone's mind was what to do about the order from Kerensky to transfer the troops out of Petrograd, which was expected any day now. Understandably, this situation led to a large swing to the left of almost all the troops in the capital. They did not want to leave for the front under any circumstances. No way, nuh-uh, not gonna happen. Lenin met with the leadership of the military organization of the Bolshevik Party. Remember, that's the organization within the Bolshevik Party responsible for organizing the armed forces, distinct from the MRC of the Petro-Soviet. Sometime between the 20th and the 23rd of October, the men in charge of the military organization were Podvoisky and Nevsky, and they and Lenin were also joined by the prolific Bolshevik Antonov Avseyenko, who at this point was a leader in the Northern Regional Congress of Soviets, mentioned in the previous episode. The four men had a spirited conversation in which Lenin impressed on the other three the importance of preparing for an overthrow of the government as soon as possible. While doubts and reservations were expressed, by the end of the meeting, Podvoisky and Nevsky agreed to funnel the efforts of the military organization through the MRC, while Antonov gave his blessing as a representative of the Northern Regional Congress. The Baltic Fleet was of particular importance during the talks. Geographically, it was in the territory represented by the Congress, and the Bolsheviks had made gigantic strides within the fleet throughout 1917. The strategic idea discussed was to send ships from the Baltic Fleet up the Neva River that flows through Petrograd to a position against the Winter Palace, which was where the government sat and is located directly on the bank of the river. On the 21st of October, a meeting of the Petrograd Garrison Conference took place. The conference was a nominally nonpartisan gathering of the soldiers stationed in the capital to deal with the impending threat of being shipped to the front. Despite their nonpartisan status, however, the conference was understandably supportive of the Bolsheviks as the only party that supported them not being sent to the front. At this meeting, the Petrograd garrison made explicit their support for the MRC. This meant the MRC was now backed by the relevant non-governmental military groups in the capital, the Bolshevik military organization, and the nonpartisan garrison conference. This support cemented the MRC as the launching pad for any decisive actions against the government. You know, just in case something like that might come up. Thus bolstered, the MRC wasted absolutely no time in challenging the provisional government directly for control over the Petrograd garrison. It immediately began dispatching its own commissars to military units across the capital, with instructions that these commissars now replaced the commissars of the Central Executive Committee, the executive body of the Soviets that had been formed at the end of the first All-Russian Congress of Soviets that had taken place in June. I will remind you, though, that I am referring to this committee, the Central Executive Committee, by its Russian acronym, CEK. The significance of this change in commissars was that the CEK was still under control of the Mensheviks and Right SRs, since they had held the majority in June. So the MRC is effectively replacing the commissars of the collaborationist parties with commissars of the revolutionary parties, the Bolsheviks and Left SRs. After issuing these dispatches, representatives of the MRC went to meet with General Polkovnikov at General Staff Headquarters late in the evening of the 21st, so late that it was after midnight by the time they actually arrived and spoke with the general, so technically this is early morning of the 22nd. Polkovnikov was the commander of the Petrograd Military District, which held authority over the garrison, as far as the government was concerned. But the MRC representatives were blunt. They informed Polkovnikov that they were now in charge of the garrison, and that any orders to the garrison not signed by the MRC were invalid. A nonplussed Polkovnikov retorted that the garrison was his responsibility, and that new MRC commissars would be arrested if they broke any laws. After this exchange, the MRC representatives left, very likely certain that if Polkovnikov thought he could simply arrest the MRC commissars, he did not fully appreciate the severity of the situation in which he and the government now found themselves. Back at its own headquarters, the MRC immediately began to discuss how best to respond to the intransigence of Polkovnikov. How could the MRC disabuse the confused general of the notion that he still had any authority over the troops of Petrograd? What they settled on was the drafting of a circular written by Trotsky to the Petrograd troops, in which the MRC publicly declared its supremacy over the Petrograd military district. In particular, the MRC informed the city garrison that any orders not countersigned by it were invalid. Later that day, mid-morning of the 22nd, the Petrograd Garrison Conference endorsed this declaration. This is huge. The MRC has unilaterally usurped the government's military authority in Petrograd by fiat, and the Petrograd garrison has pledged its loyalty to the MRC. This can be construed as the beginning of the series of events known as the October Revolution, since this circular puts the MRC and the Petrosoviet on a direct collision course with the provisional government. For that reason, it is an important document of the revolution. And for that reason, I have included it here as a supplemental. All that day, the 22nd, crowds of workers and soldiers gathered in the streets to listen to Bolsheviks talk. The Bolsheviks declared that the German army was still an imminent threat to the capital, that a socialist revolution was on the verge of sweeping across Europe and the globe, and that once taking power, the Soviets would immediately sue for peace and an end to the war. Meanwhile, Polkovnikov and Kerensky were desperately trying to address the mutinous insurrection they now had on their hands. Polkovnikov tried to talk it out with the MRC, but the committee held firm. Any orders not countersigned by it were invalid, period. When his negotiations failed, he met with Kerensky and the rest of the governmental cabinet to discuss options. The prime minister tried to call in reinforcements from outside the city, but the commanders of the hoped-for reinforcements told him that such a move was not possible. The troops would not march on the capital without guarantees that they were not to be used against the Petrosoviet and the revolution. Kerensky then tried to have the leaders of the MRC arrested, but Polkovnikov explained that that would simply be too provocative. He understood full well that, with the loss of control over the troops in the capital, the provisional government was teetering on the edge of total collapse, and that such a move would only provoke the workers and soldiers into pushing them over that edge. The general instead pleaded that the crisis could be handled peacefully. He still hoped that the MRC could be persuaded to rescind its declaration and hand back control of the garrison through negotiations, and that he would be the one to persuade them. Oh, and in case you're wondering, the Russian word for delusion is priet. Meanwhile, the new MRC commissars were greeted across the city garrison with warm enthusiasm, and on the 23rd of October, the MRC gained a massive strategic advantage over the provisional government. They won the allegiance of the troops stationed in the Peter and Paul fortress. They did this by having Bolsheviks give speeches the entire day of the 23rd to the troops in the fortress square. There were right SRs and Mensheviks present to plead their case as well, but they were largely ignored in favor of the Bolshevik speakers. By the evening of the 23rd, by an overwhelming majority, the troops of the Peter and Paul fortress voted to support the MRC. This was a huge development for a couple of reasons. First of all, just days before, these same fortress troops had resisted the MRC and rejected its authority, no doubt under the influence of the Mensheviks and right SRs. The fact that mere days later, through rousing speeches and appeals from troops outside the fortress, the troops inside were being persuaded to support the MRC, testifies to the rapidly changing atmosphere at this time. But the second reason is because, in relation to the Winter Palace where the provisional government sat, the Peter and Paul Fortress is right there. The Winter Palace is on the left bank of the Neva River, and the fortress is positioned on a large island nestled tightly against the right bank of the Neva, directly across from the palace. If you are standing on the left embankment with the palace behind you facing across the river, the fortress is maybe 500 yards, or 450 meters, away. So the fact that the cannons and small arms of the fortress were now in the hands of the MRC, which was in turn an organization of the Petrosoviet, which in turn was held in majority by the Bolsheviks, who were now actively trying to subvert and overthrow the provisional government, all this had a huge psychological impact on the balance of forces in the capital. The masses, of course, were thrilled. The government, on the other hand, was on the verge of panic. Amazingly, however, even at this late hour and with all this momentum built on their side, there was no overwhelming consensus in the Petrosoviet and MRC to finally overthrow the government. The left SRs were still not fully committed to armed insurrection, and reports of the mood of the soldiers, both in the capital and at the front, were skeptical that they would support any attempt at overthrowing the government ahead of the Congress of Soviets, which gave even seasoned Bolsheviks pause. It is at this point that we see a somewhat surprising move from the Military Revolutionary Committee, when it officially rescinded the circular declaring that all orders from the Petrograd Military District not countersigned by the MRC were not valid. This move was not precipitated by any breakthrough in negotiations with the government. Instead, a crack appeared within the MRC leadership when a pair of Mensheviks, Gots and Bogdanov, threatened to have the Tsikh break off relations with the MRC. This spooked the left SRs and the more moderate Bolsheviks, since such a public split between the MRC and Petrosoviet on the one hand, and the Tsikh as the authority of the nationwide Congress of Soviets on the other, was one of the only things that could derail everything to which the revolution had been building. Thus, the circular was rescinded. Instead of this being a retreat, however, it was more a delaying tactic. Even with the declaration officially rescinded, the MRC still retained de facto authority over soldiers in Petrograd. It's not like the armed forces were suddenly going to start following Kerensky's orders again. And besides, in about 48 hours, guess what? The question of who is officially in control of the Petrograd garrison will be moot anyway. Speaking of the Prime Minister, just what has he been doing as control of the capital has been slipping away from him the last few days? Kerensky was, naturally, enraged at the affront to his authority. If he could not arrest the MRC straight away, his cabinet of ministers decided to charge the MRC with insurrection, which, to be fair, is a completely accurate charge, as a valid reason to return to jail those Bolsheviks, including Trotsky, who had been released on bond following the Kornilov affair, but who, while out on bond, had clearly violated its terms. In addition to this, the cabinet decided to close down the Bolshevik papers Soldat and Rabochi Put, as well as a pair of far-right newspapers in an attempt to make the crackdown seem impartial. The offices of the Trud printing presses, which put out Soldat and Rabochi Put, were raided early morning on the 24th. The presses were taken out of commission, and reports of the MRC being prosecuted for insurrection and Bolshevik leaders being targeted for arrest began spreading. But even this victory for the government was short-lived. Trotsky, via the MRC, ordered the Trud presses reopened and secured from further disruption in their work, which they were almost immediately and without difficulty. Curiously, however, despite the obvious weakness of the government and the strength of the revolutionary left, the order to attack the government outright was still not given quite yet. And in fact, there were denials from Trotsky and the MRC that an armed conflict was imminent. Articles from Stalin, Trotsky, and the MRC were printed in various newspapers, assuring the public that the Congress of Soviets opening the next day would be making any decisions about how to handle the government, and that the MRC had no intention to take matters into its own hands. Meanwhile, Kerensky's despair was only deepening. He was still frantically searching for troops he could transfer from the front to the capital, but was finding it difficult to A. locate any loyal troops to transfer in the first place, and B. extract those few loyal troops he could find out of the regiments and battalions in which they were embedded, since in the majority of cases, these regiments and battalions sided with the Bolsheviks and the MRC, and so would not allow these troops out. His anxiety was, I am sure, only exacerbated when the naval command attempted to deploy the battle cruiser Aurora from the shipyards of Petrograd out to sea, but was unsuccessful. The Aurora had been docked in Petrograd for repairs, and its 500-man crew supported the Bolsheviks to the hilt. As such, they understood the order to be a blatant attempt to sideline the cruiser and deprive the Bolsheviks of the sailors' support. The MRC was successful in persuading the naval command to rescind the order by arguing, and I'm paraphrasing here, quote, "Come on, do you really want to go through the humiliation of having the order publicly ignored? Because we will tell you right now, those sailors are not going anywhere." Kerensky then turned to what he still thought of as a legitimate source of support, the pre-parliament. In the afternoon of the 24th, he appeared at a session of the pre-parliament in what would turn out to be his final public appearance as a Russian politician. The Prime Minister decried the Bolsheviks one last time for being German agents and delivering Russia to the German Kaiser, and requested an endorsement from the pre-parliament for a heavy-handed crackdown on the Bolsheviks. However, in a move that hilariously and completely encapsulates the impotence of the government at every turn, in response to Kerensky's insistence that they were facing an emergency and that swift action was needed, instead of taking that swift action, the pre-parliament decided it would be better to break out into fractional groups to discuss how best to respond to the crisis. In the end, the pre-parliament debated three different proposals for how to respond, and went with what was definitely the most left-leaning of them, but which was not anywhere near sufficient a reaction for the moment at hand. Effectively, the pre-parliament voted no confidence in Kerensky and insisted a land and peace program be instituted and a committee of public safety, made up of government and Soviet officials, be set up to broker a peace and restore order in the capital before the pre-parliament would support the government. When Kerensky was presented later that evening with these demands in person by the Mensheviks Don and Gotz, he rejected them out of hand. He was the prime minister, and he was not about to give up his post just because the rabble were rousing. Whatever hope there had been that Kerensky would defuse the situation and agree to reforms in order to avoid revolution evaporated at this moment. Of course, it is worth pointing out that there is no guarantee that, had Kerensky accepted the pre-parliament's resolution, A, it would have worked, and B, the government would not have blundered its way into another crisis, since that was all the government seemed capable of doing anymore anyway. The masses of Petrograd were becoming highly adversarial, or, one might say, highly class-conscious. And while announcing reforms would likely have deprived the Soviets and Bolsheviks of a bit of the momentum that they were building, any reforms would still need to be decided on. The cadets would still need to agree to them. The masses would still have to accept them as sufficient. And then they would actually need to be implemented. But do we really think that all of that would have gone off without a hitch? So in its last moments, the government is realizing just how paralyzed it is, and how the Bolsheviks and Soviets have outmaneuvered the government at almost every turn. To bring back the analogy with chess, this is the definition of positional play. Gain a small positional advantage, the institution of dual power back in February and March. Build on it to create momentum. There are many examples, but the defeat of Kornilov is the most obvious. And eventually, your opponent either makes a mistake out of desperation or simply runs out of good moves to play, which is what we are seeing now from Kerensky. The rest of the day of the 24th saw government forces make half-hearted and unsuccessful attempts at rolling back the overwhelming positional superiority of the Petro-Soviet and Bolsheviks. For example, a company from the 1st Petrograd Women's Shock Battalion was ordered to secure a bridge across the Neva, but this bridge was in the shadow of the Peter and Paul Fortress, with its machine guns and cannons loaded on the top of the walls. So you can imagine how strict the troops actually were about controlling traffic across the bridge. A detachment of military cadets, not the political party, actual young male military cadets from the Mikhailovsky Academy, tried to secure another bridge, the Litivsky, but were rebuffed by a crowd of citizens. The citizens were not acting on any orders or directives from the Soviet or the MRC. They just did not want to give up the bridge to the cadets. Outnumbered and outgunned, the cadets were forced to give up their own arms and return to the academy, thoroughly embarrassed. And these are just two examples. There are many more such stories, but we have no time to recount them all. The point is, whatever the government thought to do at this point was either not feasible, woefully inadequate, or easily countered and undone by the revolutionary forces. Lenin, meanwhile, and yes, it has been a minute since we checked in with him, was simultaneously excited by all these developments and also dismayed that the final push for the overthrow of the government did not seem forthcoming. The afternoon of the 25th was the opening of the Second Congress of Soviets, and was now only 24 hours away. He still conceived of the opening of the Congress as the ultimate deadline for the revolution. Otherwise, the congressional delegates may sow confusion by denouncing everything that had taken place over the last week, and the government might actually find loyal troops to bring in and organize a counterattack. Yes, Lenin was still convinced the deed had to be done before the opening of the Congress, and became more and more agitated with each passing hour in which the deed was not done. Unfortunately, he was still forced to keep a low profile, as the government had confirmed the arrest warrant for Lenin that had been issued in the wake of the July days. But of course, Lennon being Lennon, he could not sit idly by. He had been staying in the apartment of a Bolshevik comrade on the outskirts, but by the evening of the 24th, he resolved to risk the trip from the Vyborg district to the Smolny Institute, the headquarters of both the Bolsheviks and the Petrosoviet. He left a note for his host, who was out at that particular moment, donned his disguise of wig and cap, and went out into the Petrograd night. Particularly attentive listeners may have picked up on a detail I have been casually mentioning this episode without any explanation. If you remember, way back in episode 5, Lights, Camera, Action, we talked about how, after the Tsar was forced to abdicate, the Petrograd Soviet and the Provisional Government wound up occupying opposing wings of the same building, the Tauride Palace. But now, the Provisional Government is in the Winter Palace, and the Petrosoviet is in this Smolny Institute? When did that happen? Well, actually, that happened after the July days. I skipped over it at the time, but after the crisis had passed, the Tauride Palace was closed for repairs, and the two power centers were forced to find different accommodations. I do not know if the repairs were legitimately needed, or, if they were, if they really necessitated the relocation of the government and Soviet, or if there were no repairs and it was simply the excuse given in order for the government to create some physical distance between itself and the Petrosoviet. After all, it is a bit of a toxic workplace if every once in a while the office down the hall tries to arrest you. In any event, the government moved into the Winter Palace, which was, honestly, very appropriate, what with the Winter Palace having been the residence of the Tsar and all. As for the Petrosoviet, it and the Bolshevik Central Committee relocated to the Smolny Institute, which had been an all-girls school for the nobility. The interesting thing is, if you look at a map of St. Petersburg today, you can see that Lenin's starting point way up in the Vyborg district and his destination at Smolny are quite far from each other. And so by going out that night, Lenin was once again demonstrating how bold, or possibly reckless, he was when it came to making sure the revolution succeeded. He went to Smolny for one reason and one reason only, to convince the Bolshevik Central Committee and the Petrosoviet to finally do away with Kerensky and the government. Once again, he knew there was no substitute for being there in person. On the other hand, on several occasions he had to dodge detachments of the few troops still loyal to the government, and he came close to being caught out in the open a few times. Had he been arrested, or had he never shown up in the first place, who knows how history would have played out? It is unlikely that the overthrow of the government could have been stopped at this point, but then again, Lenin was one of the only authoritative voices insisting for weeks now that the government be overthrown as soon as possible. Even at this late hour, it was not until Lenin arrived at Smolny, which he did after midnight on the 25th, that the Soviet and the Bolshevik Central Committee seemed actually interested in delivering the killing stroke to the government. Within hours after Lenin's arrival, the MRC switched from issuing passive orders to hold so-and-so position and await further orders, to issuing more aggressive orders preparing for movement on the government. So while we do not know what would have happened if Lenin had been arrested, we do know that he was not, and that his presence at Smolny immediately lent the urgency necessary to finish the job. The job was able to be finished in no small part thanks to the meticulous subversion of the Provisional Government by the Bolshevik and left SR leadership of the Petrosoviet and MRC. Starting already on the 24th and continuing into the pre-dawn hours of the 25th, MRC troops took control of the central hubs of communication across the capital, the rail stations, the post, the telegraph, the wire news agencies, electric stations, telephone centers, and more of the myriad of bridges that crisscross the waterways of Petrograd. Even the state bank was occupied. The MRC shut off telephone and electric services to the palace and other government offices, underlining just how much control they wielded over the situation. Rather impressively, there were almost no skirmishes at any of these locations. The Soviet troops were either not met by any opposition when they arrived, or there were government troops who quickly retreated in the face of numerically superior detachments. And I have to say, there is something satisfyingly thorough about this last bit. We often think of revolutions as bloodshed and street clashes, where the outcome is not immediately certain, but the excitement and energy is high, rather akin to tactical play in chess. Taking control of such strategic points of infrastructure and communication may seem banal and boring by contrast, rather akin to positional play. However, it is as true today as it was over 100 years ago that the infrastructure upon which everyone relies, whether it be railroads, telegraphs, and post offices, or airports, satellites, and computer servers, is the key to isolating and weakening even the most seemingly powerful institutions and governments. Again, superb positional play from the Bolsheviks and Petrosoviet. Speaking of positions, the battlecruiser Aurora finally left the shipyard where it was being repaired, but it was not headed out to sea. Instead, the Aurora moved into the position for which history would come to know it, winding its way through the Neva River to settle opposite the Winter Palace. But the Aurora was only one movement of the armed forces on the 25th. Echelons of sailors departed from both Baltic Fleet headquarters at Helsingfors and the Kronstadt Naval Base for Petrograd, arriving in waves throughout the day. The Baltic Fleet sailors traveled over land via train, but they were followed by a small flotilla of ships also dispatched to the capital. The flotilla would arrive that afternoon. So now, Kerensky is not only facing an insurrectionary city garrison and a combative working class. He knows that soon, soldiers and sailors from beyond the capital will be arriving to support not him, but them. Trapped in a hopeless position, the Prime Minister was nonetheless frantically trying to find a way out. He bounced from meeting to meeting with generals and cabinet officials, desperate for some good news, any good news. He played one of the last moves available to him by appealing to the Cossacks in the capital, those fiercely reactionary crack troops upon which Russian Tsars had relied for centuries, and whose praise he had sung at a state funeral for the fallen after the July days. But by now, even the Cossacks could see the writing on the wall. They knew Kerensky's number was up, and so, citing a desire not to serve as living targets for the masses when they finally did strike, the overwhelming majority of Cossack troops in Petrograd refused Kerensky's plea for help. Some did heed the call and showed up to the palace, but it was a pitiful number, and as we will soon see, they do not really end up doing much of anything. Rather hilariously, it was now, early morning on the 25th, with the government trapped in the Winter Palace, nearly every major piece of infrastructure in and around Petrograd under the firm and undisputed control of the revolutionary masses, and reports of reinforcements coming from Helsingfors and Kronstadt, that General Polkovnikov sent Kerensky a report in which he warned that the situation in the capital was critical and the government had no reliable troops at its disposal. Truly, an analytical mind to rival Lenin's. I have to imagine Kerensky read the report and thought to himself, gee, thanks, tell me something I don't know. So here we are. It is Wednesday, the 25th of October, 1917. Old style date, of course. In the chess game of the revolution, the revolutionary masses have obtained an overwhelming position, the government has been deprived of any possible recourse to defend itself, and so now, the only thing left to do is deliver checkmate. If you are enjoying this show and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. I have some good news and bad news. The good news is I'm happy to say the Patreon page is fully functional now. All my current episodes have been posted there. There are different tiers with different bonuses, and we are forming a nice little community. The bad news is, you are listening to this episode late. All new episodes come out immediately on Patreon first, but then 10 days later on the RSS feed. Early access on Patreon starts at just $5 a month, so if you don't want to wait, head on over and sign up. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever podcast services you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. Mid-morning of the 25th, the MRC and Bolshevik Party were jointly completing plans for the overthrow of the provisional government. They at first would offer the government a chance to surrender peacefully, but if they refused, the Winter Palace would be shelled from the Peter and Paul Fortress and the Aurora. Before these plans were even completed, however, Lenin composed and sent out a proclamation titled, "To the Citizens of Russia." It is exactly the kind of document I would include as a supplemental to this episode, but it is extremely short, so I'm just going to read it here. Quote, "To the citizens of Russia, the provisional government has been overthrown. State authority has passed into the hands of the organ of the Petrograd Soviet of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies, the Military Revolutionary Committee, which stands at the head of the Petrograd Proletariat and Garrison. The cause for which the people have been fighting, the immediate offering of a democratic peace, the abolition of landowner property, worker control over production, the creation of a Soviet government, this cause has been secured. Long live the revolution of workers, soldiers, and peasants. Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet of Workers and Soldiers' Deputies, the 25th of October, 1917, 10 o'clock in the morning." End quote. Lenin was sending this out in the press and over telegraph before, of course, the overthrow of the government had technically been completed. Was this a display of hubris, as adversaries of the Bolsheviks and Lenin might accuse? I do not think so. I think Lenin wanted both to focus the concentration of masses on completing the overthrow, a kind of, the victory is ours, we have only to take it appeal. But also, I believe he was trying to force the hand of the MRC and Bolsheviks to hurry up already and finish the deed, since the masses would now be expecting it. By 10 a.m. that day, there were only hours until the Congress of Soviets opened. Tick-tock. But if Lenin was worried about time running out on the Petrosoviet, Prime Minister Kerensky was, at the exact moment Lenin was publishing his proclamation, realizing that his time had finally run out. He had spent the last 24 hours trying desperately to make every appeal he could to every group he could, the pre-parliament, the army, the Cossacks. Nobody was willing or able to come to his rescue. Therefore, he suddenly announced to his ministers and aides that he needed to leave the capital in order to rally loyal troops for a counterattack in person. I have a hard time imagining anyone actually believed this was possible, or that this was the actual reason Kerensky was suddenly desperate to leave. It must have seemed transparently a ploy for him to save his own hide. In any event, since all the rail stations were in the hands of Soviet troops, and not even the general staff could locate a singular vehicle suitable for travel, Kerensky was forced to borrow a car from the American embassy. He, an aide, and two staff officers huddled in the back seat, trying not to be noticed as the vehicle sped out of the center of Petrograd. The story goes that Kerensky fled the capital, quote, dressed as a woman. But this is an apocryphal detail concocted to humiliate Kerensky and his legacy even further. Putting aside the cringy weaponization of gender, this is, for all practical purposes, Kerensky's ignoble end in Russian politics, and thus, his end in our story. He does have a small coda. In the week or so after fleeing, he will try to lead troops in an effort to take back the capital. But it turns out he was as effective at military leadership as he was at political leadership, and the tiny number of forces he could muster were wholly inadequate to the task to which he set them. And ultimately, they would be repelled by the workers and soldiers of Petrograd, who were not about to let Kerensky back into their lives. He will hang around for a bit when the Civil War kicks off, but he finally fled Russia in May 1918, when he got wind that some of his own troops were willing to hand him over to the communists, as the Bolsheviks were calling themselves by then, as part of a deal for themselves. He settled for a time in France before eventually winding up in New York after World War II. He spent the remainder of his life teaching Russian history courses and working with the Hoover Institute, the notorious right-wing free market think tank. In this way, Kerensky was the first of many, many individuals throughout Soviet history whose personal experiences were cherry-picked by capitalist forces around the world, whose bravery to denounce the evils of communism were exalted and presented as truth and gospel, all while completely ignoring the vast majority of Soviet citizens who were perfectly happy to have their living standards raised year after year and either trusted the Soviet government or were active participants in it. But that's getting ahead of ourselves quite a bit. Getting back to Kerensky, although he was happy to talk to anyone who would listen about how unfairly he had been treated by the conniving Bolsheviks who had robbed him of his destiny to lead Russia into bourgeois democracy, or whatever stories he spun about what had happened, it seems he never really escaped the label of being the guy who lost Russia to the communists. So although he was the first anti-communist and anti-Soviet figurehead, I do not believe he was a particularly effective one, even during the Cold War when anti-communist propaganda was in high demand in the United States. But I could be wrong. I genuinely do not know. Alexander Fyodorovich Kerensky passed away on the 11th of June, 1970, in a hospital in New York, at the surprising old age of 89. This makes him one of the last living participants of the events of 1917. Which is kind of wild when you think about it. He outlived just about every Bolshevik from this period, including, of course, Lenin, Stalin, and Trotsky. In fact, having been born in 1881, he had been only 36 when he fled Petrograd. His body was flown to London, where his sons lived, and he was buried in a non-denominational cemetery, since the Russian Orthodox Church refused him burial rights, blaming him for losing Russia to the communists. So Kerensky is gone, but of course the MRC, the Bolsheviks, and the Petro-Soviet are not aware of this. The opening of the Second Congress is fast approaching, and in fact, the deadline Lenin had been so insistent on will be missed by only a few hours. Fortunately, though, the position of the revolutionaries will be so overwhelming and superior that, in the end, it will not matter. But for this last little bit, events outside the Winter Palace and inside Smolny are going to be happening simultaneously, and so we are going to be jumping back and forth a bit between the two. Over the course of the 25th, the MRC broke up the pre-parliament meeting in the Maninsky Palace. The few remaining Bolsheviks imprisoned in the Crosses, the famous old prison which had held Trotsky after the July days, were released on order by an MRC commissar, and the sailors and ships from Kronstadt and the Baltic Fleet headquarters arrived to enthusiastic cheers from the masses. Many of the now 3,000 armed sailors joined the military detachments preparing to storm the Winter Palace. In Smolny, Trotsky called an emergency meeting of the Petro-Soviet, at which he also proclaimed the end of the provisional government. While he was speaking, though, Lenin appeared in the hall, making his first public appearance in over 3 months, ever since being forced underground back in July. Remember, as recently as 12 hours ago, Lenin had had to dodge arrest on the streets of the city. As much as his presence had been felt since his return to Petrograd, it was only in meetings with other Bolsheviks and in the presses. Only now, with the government effectively neutralized, did he feel confident enough to appear in public. The deputies of the Soviet erupted in cheers when Lenin appeared, and they listened excitedly to Lenin speaking of the new era that was starting for Russia as the Soviets would take power, form an alliance with the peasants, and for the first time control their own destinies as they built the world's first proletariat socialist state. Soon after Lenin's remarks, the meeting ended, and Lenin and Trotsky's attention turned back to the Winter Palace. Despite their proclamations, the palace was still conspicuously not in the hands of the Soviet, and this needed to be addressed as soon as possible. Much to their chagrin, it would still be several hours before the storming of the palace took place. The delay can be attributed to last-minute details and preparations that were hitting snags and causing issues. As in chess, even with an overwhelmingly superior position, precise play is needed, and the MRC and Bolshevik forces, to their credit, were meticulous even in these final moments. Better to attack when everything is already in place and ready to go. And at this point, somewhat paradoxically, even though Lenin really wanted the Winter Palace in the hands of the revolution before the Congress opened, time was also slowly working in favor of the revolution. With Kerensky gone and just about every strategically important point in the city firmly in the hands of the MRC, the troops facing the palace knew that they could, if they so choose, simply wait out the besieged individuals in the palace. Morale among what was left of the government was plummeting. Absolutely no preparations for a siege had been made, and so the people inside the palace were faced with no electricity, no communications, and no food or supplies. As time passed, the few troops actually defending the Winter Palace realized there were no reinforcements or provisions coming, and throughout the afternoon and into the evening of the 25th, they began abandoning their posts. On the flip side, the revolutionary forces were eager to avoid massive bloodshed, and so were all too willing to let these troops leave without incident. Besides, the more the people inside the palace saw how defenseless they were, the less likely they would be to resist with force. By 6:30 that evening, what remained of the provisional government was presented with an ultimatum: surrender or be fired upon. Bewilderingly, the government ministers, abandoned by their prime minister, surrounded on all sides, with their troops deserting and no chance of resisting an assault, refused to capitulate. It appears from the memoirs of one of the ministers present that they decided that, for posterity's sake, and no, I'm not kidding, they must hold out until the very last moment, so that they could say that they resisted the fall of the Russian Republic until the very last. The deadline for surrender came and went, and yet, to the surprise of the ministers, the revolutionary forces outside did not stir. This was because they were overcoming a few persistent technical difficulties, as well as investigating a false rumor that the Winter Palace had, in fact, surrendered. But soon enough, the commanders of the Peter and Paul Fortress determined the rumor was false, and when the technical difficulties were resolved, the order was finally given at 9:40 p.m. to fire one blank on the Winter Palace, to signal the opening of the attack on the building and the government inside. The unexpected and deafening boom from the blank fired by the Aurora startled everyone both inside and outside of the palace, and compelled even more government forces to desert. After some time had passed and it seemed everyone who was going to had left, the shelling of the Winter Palace started in earnest only at around 11 p.m. Amazingly, the damage to the palace was not nearly as bad as everyone had anticipated. It was expected that the palace, which was one of the largest buildings in all the city, would be reduced to rubble. In fact, the ministers inside, before deciding not to surrender, had talked amongst themselves about how just the Aurora could demolish the building by herself, never mind the other ships and the fortress. But in fact, it appears the revolutionaries were not interested in demolishing the building, only in showing their destructive capacity and encouraging the remaining government forces to surrender without a fight. The Winter Palace escaped with some broken windows and a few walls blown in. Nothing that could not be fixed once the matter at hand was resolved, and so, in the end, kind of a best-case scenario for lovers of culture and history. Meanwhile, back at Smolny, the time had finally arrived. The second All-Russian Congress of Soviets had been scheduled to start at 2 p.m., but given the events happening in the city, the start had kept being pushed back. Finally, at 10:40 p.m., just before the order to shell the Winter Palace was given, the Menshevik Don called the Congress into session. Of the 670 deputies in the Congress, nearly 400 were Bolsheviks and left SRs. The Mensheviks and right SRs counted only around 175 deputies, depending on how one counts the roles. With the 90 or so remaining deputies belonging to those smaller parties and groups I keep mentioning, but skipping right over. Immediately, debate erupted over what to do about the insurrection taking place at that very moment. In fact, the deputies of the Congress soon could hear the shells exploding over the Winter Palace in the distance. The who and when of what was said in these debates is not important for our purposes here, but if you want those details, they are available in Rabinowitz's book, which has served as an invaluable source in the show thus far. Ultimately, the breakdown of the Congress occurred more or less exactly as Lenin had predicted. The Mensheviks and right SRs denounced the Bolsheviks for their crimes against the government, against the revolution, against democracy, and against the people. The Bolsheviks and left SRs accused them of undermining and ignoring the will of the workers, the soldiers, and the peasants. At the heart of the disagreement was the refusal of the Mensheviks and SRs to accept the legitimacy of what the Bolsheviks and Petrosoviet had orchestrated. In the end, after heated words and all sorts of whistling and shouting had been exchanged, the Mensheviks and right SRs voluntarily abandoned the Congress in protest. This move turned out to be practically the final political blunder of the Mensheviks and right SRs. With the provisional government overthrown, the Congress was now the supreme authority in Russia. By walking out of the Congress, they walked away from any chance they had of exercising legitimate power in the new order, and ceded all political power to the Bolsheviks and left SRs. They also cemented forever their political legacy. Throughout the entirety of 1917, these parties have, at every turn, refused to step up and take power when it is offered to them. The dogmatism of their Marxist belief in the rule of the bourgeoisie after the fall of feudalism and before the rise of the proletariat seems to have infected them with an allergy to exercising power. They called the overthrow of the provisional government illegitimate because it was in conflict with the democratic principles of, wait, what exactly? There was no constitution. The provisional government had never been elected. Its coalitions had only been formed by consent of a narrow number of people whose own claim to legitimate power lay in their positions in the Petrosoviet and as holdovers from the Fourth Duma. Elections to the Constituent Assembly had finally been scheduled, but we will soon see that the time for the Constituent Assembly to be regarded as a legitimate and relevant body had already passed. On the other hand, the popularly elected Soviets had been calling for weeks now for the transfer of power to them and had been ignored. In fact, the Mensheviks and right SRs had either been deaf to their calls or actively militated against them. So now, left with no other choice for how to end the war and address the concerns of the peasants for land and of the workers for a dignified existence, the masses had finally resorted to the only avenue left to them, force, to enact this demand. And what, they are supposed to pull a 180 because, oops, a minority in the Soviets did not approve, and elections to the Constituent Assembly were being called at the last minute? That's not how power works. This also is the exact moment the left SRs graduate from a fraction to a full-fledged party. Obviously, they've been playing a vital role in revolutionary politics for a few months now, and particularly in the weeks leading up to the October Revolution. But by staying in the Congress, the left SRs officially broke from the party that birthed them. Their willingness to collaborate with the Bolsheviks and their support for the overthrow of the government would demonstrate that the Bolsheviks were, in fact, willing to work with anyone who was willing to work with them, as long as it was on the grounds of revolutionary workers' power and not bourgeois power. Sadly, this coalition with the left SRs did not last very long, but the reasons for this are complex, and we will get into that when the time comes. When we do, I will have much more to say about the accusations that the Bolsheviks were anti-democratic in their construction of a one-party state. For now, it is enough only to note that it is the right SRs and Mensheviks who are refusing to work with the Bolsheviks, not the other way around. Meanwhile, back where the action was taking place, the shelling of the Winter Palace had stopped, and the actual taking of the palace was underway. It was now after midnight, and so we are on the 26th on the calendar. The government ministers sat in a meeting room on the second floor, listening to the firefights taking place in different locations around the palace. As can be understood, the ministers were completely dejected. Many of them were nervous wrecks, and they all just wanted everything to end. To their relief, the Bolshevik Antonov Avsyentka eventually entered the meeting room with a detachment of soldiers and declared the ministers there under arrest. There was a brief moment of disappointment and anger when the soldiers realized Kerensky was not there, and there were angry calls to kill the remaining ministers on the spot. Antonov, however, would not allow it, and instead ordered the ministers taken to the Peter and Paul fortress, to the Trubetskoy prison in the fortress. Rabinowitz recounts that one of the ministers, Nikitin, as he was being placed in his cell, found a telegram in his pocket that he had received from the Ukrainian Rada, their version of the Duma, that had been received by the Ministry of the Interior. He handed the telegram to Antonov Avsyentka and said, "I received this yesterday. It's your problem now." The number of casualties in the struggle between the Soviets and the government over the course of the last few days was surprisingly small, and almost all of them had been sustained during the fighting in and around the palace on the 25th and the 26th. Overall, a rather impressive and surprising outcome, if you think about it. If things had gone differently, if the Soviet forces had been more impatient and less meticulous, there could have been a lot more dead and wounded workers, soldiers, cadets, and government ministers. But as it went, the casualties were minimal. By 3 a.m. on the 26th of October, only 4 hours after the opening of the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets, truly and officially, the provisional government was no more. Which brings us to the final act in the series of events we call the October Revolution. When news of the arrest of the government ministers reached Smolny and the Congress, it fell to, of all people, Kamenev, the man who had fought for 6 weeks against an insurrection, lest it fail, to read the announcement to the gathered deputies. As you might imagine, the hall erupted in cheers and frenetic energy as everyone realized that they had done it. They had won. The government of the bourgeoisie was no longer. And as if to underscore and circle this fact in red ink, once order was restored to the congressional session, reports were read aloud of multiple divisions and regiments refusing to fight for Kerensky and the provisional government. A handful of regiments who had actually managed to come to Petrograd on Kerensky's orders joyfully declared their refusal to spill their own blood, or the blood of their brothers in arms, or the people of Petrograd, in defense of the bourgeoisie. The Congress also learned of a military revolutionary committee that had formed among the troops of the Northern Front to combat any attempts at deploying them against the Petrosoviet or the Congress. To cap off the events of the October Revolution, the Bolshevik Lunacharsky read a decree that had been written by Lenin announcing the overthrow of the provisional government and the transfer of all state power into the hands of the Soviets. This decree was adopted with a small change at the request of the left SRs by an overwhelming majority, with just 2 votes against and 12 abstaining. This decree is the second supplemental for this episode and serves as a bookend to the first. The MRC circular set the Petrosoviet on a collision course with the government. The congressional decree announced that the Soviet system had emerged the victor. And with this final act done, the congressional session ended around 5 a.m. on the 26th. Understandably, everyone was exhausted. Officials from the MRC, the Petrosoviet, and the Bolshevik Party had been awake for days on end, and even the deputies of the new Soviet government had just been through what I can only imagine must have been a mentally and emotionally draining 7 hours. But in the final pre-dawn hours of the 26th of October, 1917, The sense pervaded among the workers and soldiers throughout the capital that they were witness to the dawn of not just a new day, but a new era for themselves, and hopefully, the world. In their final days, as we have seen, Kerensky and his government were blind to the realities of their position until it was too late. He somehow did not understand how little support he had, not just within the capital, not just among the workers in the cities, but among the armed forces and out in the countryside as well, and, correspondingly, was blind to the positional advantage which the masses, led by the Bolsheviks, had been building ever since victory in the Kornilov affair. By mid-October, the Bolsheviks, the vanguard party of the revolutionary left, had taken over the Soviets across the country, made massive gains among the troops all along the fronts, and joined forces with the breakaway fraction of the SR party, the left SRs, which represented the most class-conscious section of the poor and working peasantry. Really, the October Revolution can leave one scratching one's head, wondering how Kerensky could have been so naive and, frankly, dumb. But if you are inclined to focus on how badly Kerensky screwed up in the end, I would gently encourage you to switch your focus to just how brilliant and bold the Bolsheviks and the masses were. The lessons that are most important to us today to take from the year 1917, and particularly the October Revolution, are not about how not to prevent a revolution, but how to win one. Yes, Kerensky was, by the end, an awful politician and lost the revolution to the Bolsheviks due to his own inadequacies and failings. But focusing on that aspect takes away from the agency of the masses of Petrograd, of the workers and soldiers and sailors who came together in one prolonged, determined, conscientious, and final push to shake off the chains of a bourgeoisie that had become a hindrance to their abilities to lead lives with dignity and security. Really, October is their story of victory much more than it can ever be Kerensky's story of failure. Kerensky and his government were not going to leave on their own. The masses still had to force them out. This is never a simple task, and the nearly bloodless and impressively efficient way in which they completed this task is, I think, worthy of admiration. If you're on the left, of course. As much as the toiling peoples around the world looked at the events in Russia with awe, enthusiasm, and hope, the bourgeoisie and aristocracy of the world looked upon them with horror. We will see that for practically the entirety of the existence of the USSR, capitalists around the globe looked at October 1917 in Petrograd and the revolutionary proletarian state it spawned and said, "Not again, not here, not ever." And they took whatever steps they thought were necessary to ensure this. Thus ends our narrative of the Russian Revolution. It sounds incredible, but I must remind you that this has all been a long prologue to the main story of our podcast. We are still 5 years away from the creation of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And what an action-packed 5 years it is. But amazingly, before we leave the revolutionary period behind and get to that action, there's still more to say, because there is always more to say about the Russian Revolution. And so next, we will have the first of what I imagine will be many retrospectives in our series. In it, instead of presenting all new information, I will be striving to put what we have just witnessed into a broader context, as well as sharing my own kind of final thoughts on the revolutions of 1917. Thank you for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. There are tiers with different incentives, and we're also forming a really nice community over there, so go check it out. A special thank you to my commissars, Kat Branigan, Comrade Red, Dr. Fate, Hyacinth Dathenes, Jay, Jack, Josue Ponce, Long Luke, Rasmussen Svensson, and Ryan Fowler. You guys are awesome. If you have not done so already, please leave a rating and review on your podcast service of choice, and share this show with anyone you think might enjoy it. Also, feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or at sovietpod@gmail.com if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hi. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.